equipment that, that they tested that eventually is now going to be used for the Restore L mission. The same science that the engineers learned from that experience, and now that deorbited in the trunk over the Pacific. So they actually finished with that on the space station. It was very successful. And maybe that's why they went ahead with Restore L. K2RIWWS to us.
I think you said earlier, Paul, that the fifth heat shield on James Webb Space Telescope runs at something like 15 degrees Kelvin, 15 Kelvin. 400 Kelvins is the heat shield toward the sun, and the fifth one away from the sun is going to be something like 15. Then the Stirling heat pump, I'm going to call it, refrigeration system, is going to bring the final infrared detector down to some much lower temperature. I'm going to guess a number like 3 Kelvins or something like that. Have they said what temperature Stirling engine will be able to bring the final infrared detector down to over your pole, K2RIW?
It's lower than 7 degrees Kelvin, I remember reading a couple of years ago. So whether it goes to 6 or 5, I don't know, but at least 7 from what I read. And that's at the detector. The rest of, you know, the gold mirror, the 21-foot diameter mirror with 18 sections. Oh, that's where you get the 18 feet. There's 18 mirrors, 8 hexagonal mirrors that are part of the James Webb telescope when it's all opened up and becomes one big mirror. And that, I think, is probably 15 degrees or something like that, they said, Kelvin. But the actual detector, by the time it gets to the detector, it's going to be a lot lower because of that refrigeration device. I think they said 7 or below.
Yeah, cooling from 15 down to 7, that sounds like an awful small amount of cooling. One of the crazy things that happens with cryogenic temperatures and detectors is that, let's assume now that you could bring the detector down to, I'm going to pick a number, 8 degrees Kelvin. Then you use a better Stirling engine that works harder, and you're able to bring it down to 4 degrees Kelvin. 8 degrees Kelvin, 4 degrees Kelvin, sounds like a small difference compared to the 290 that we live at. However, whenever you half the total number of degrees Kelvin, the sensitivity of your detector, the signal-to-noise ratio, just improved by a 2-to-1 ratio. 4 degrees Kelvin versus 8 degrees Kelvin. 4 degrees Kelvin is half the amount of random noise, that detector. So you have the capability of being twice as sensitive. So, there are laboratories on planet Earth that can get you down to a micro Kelvin. It takes a room full of equipment to do that. So, if James Webb's final detector is only going to be at 7 Kelvin, I'm skeptical of that. I think it's going to get a little bit better than that, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Well, what? 3 degree Kelvin is space itself, right? The background space. Then you want to be able to go below that. Maybe a sensitive enough piece of equipment to go below. Be more sensitive if you can go below the 3 degrees background radiation.
Yeah, let me tell you the mathematics on that one, Paul. If your detector in James Webb is at 3 degrees Kelvin, and the background sky you're looking at is 3 degrees Kelvin, that means of all the noise your detector is seeing, half of it's coming from your own hardware, half of it's coming from space. If by some magic you could bring it down to a micro Kelvin, almost zero, then the total amount of noise your detector would see would be half the amount of noise. Still be getting the background of space at 3 degrees, but you wouldn't be getting another 3 degrees Kelvin from your own hardware. The total number of watts of heat, so to speak, is directly proportional to total Kelvins of the devices involved. WS2N, K2RIW.
You know, I've seen pictures of WMAP with the whole universe background radiation. So I wonder if that had a similar type of thing. I wonder what that temperature got down to. You know, I've never looked at the, you can probably find that. The WMAP system, they got down to, you know, numbers like 3 or 4 or 2. You know, I'm sure by now James Webb is, you know, more advanced. He years have gone by, maybe they can get it down that low too.
Yeah, there's another crazy thing going on here, Paul, called radiometry. Even if your detector was, let me pick a number, 20 degrees Kelvin, the next question somebody would ask is, could you tell the difference between a dim star that is at 3 degrees Kelvin versus a dim star that's at 2 degrees Kelvin when your own detector is running at 20? By radiometry techniques, the answer is absolutely yes. That would be a minus 10 or 15 dB of signal-to-noise ratio. Radiometry techniques allows you to pretty precisely measure noise temperatures that are 30 dB weaker than your own detector. So by radiometry, you can predict the temperature of that part of space, even though your own detector is considerably hotter than that. It's a crazy averaging and comparison technique, a Dickey switching comparison technique. Over you, Paul, K2RIW.
Well, that sounds good. Very good. I'll have to look into the refrigeration devices that they have, different machines. Kobe was one, Cosmic Background. That satellite that took pictures of the Milky Way and all in the infrared. They all had that. So maybe they all had that radiometry system. I mean, that took pictures of the whole galaxy. One other thing, there is a satellite that's supposed to go up. Here's something that I don't think the robots would be able to fix. So I'm glad they found this before this one goes up. Another Tedris, the last of the Tedris satellites is supposed to go up. The 13th one, since the 1980s. This is the tracking data relay satellite system that mostly NASA and Hubble uses. Let me drop it. A lot of satellites in there. Earth orbit, low Earth orbit, use tracking data relay satellites. There's a series of three or four around the globe that are always geosynchronous orbit that allow us to, for instance, communicate with the International Space Station on almost a 24-hour basis. You know, the signal from the space station goes out to Tedris and comes back down to land some which way. But this last satellite was going to go up, and it was being encapsulated in a bearing, getting ready to go up on an Atlas rocket, and there was an accident, and it hit the, apparently something hit the omnidirectional antenna, not these two big parabolic dish antennas that come out, but the Tedris, that's what it looks like, these big two antennas that are looking down. But this was an S-band. Omnidirectional antenna that got damaged. Of course, they're delaying this thing, many, many weeks or maybe even a month. It was supposed to go up, I think, August 3rd from Cape Canaveral. But, imagine that thing being broken, and first of all, you'd have to have a robot satellite go all the way out to geosynchronous orbit. We haven't been able to do that yet. Restore L is going to be in low Earth orbit. Even if you get out there, I mean, what do you do to fix, a bent up, crunched up, omnidirectional, maybe something there with a, bad coax connect, who knows what's wrong with this thing. I think that would be a tough repair job for a robot. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, when it comes to a repair robot, like Restore L mission, have to even begin to talk about refueling things in geosynchronous orbit. That's an interesting repair. I wonder, on a slightly related subject, do you own any Baofeng radios? Because the antenna that's shipped with Baofeng has a built-in 3 picofarad capacitor that's inside of the rubber duck antenna. And if you bend the rubber duck antenna a few times, you disconnect that capacitor. While I'm talking to you tonight, I resoldered that capacitor inside of my rubber duck antenna of my Baofeng radio, UV5R. I just resoldered it for the third time. You go down 20 dB in sensitivity when that 3 picofarad capacitor breaks contact. So I wonder if you own any Baofengs or if you talk to anybody who has done that rubber duck repair. It's an interesting process you have to go through. WS2N, K2IW.
No, I don't. I have the... For HDM, ICOM, I see V8, but I don't have that one. I know a lot of people on the air do have that. Sounds like a very popular radio. What is the idea of this capacitor doing in the middle of an antenna? Some kind of a matching device? What in the world do they have there? To me, should have a come up with a helical connection type of thing, and that should be it. What's the idea of that? You know, then?
Yes, bear in mind that the rubber duck on the Baofeng UV5R series has to operate on 2 meters, 440, and it's got to operate between, 430 and 450, and I think it goes to 480 or so. It takes a huge space in the 450 band, a huge space in the 2 meter band. I think it'll tune from 144 to 160, I mean numbers like that. So it's got two separate bands, a broad range of both bands. As such, that is not an ordinary rubber duck. Let me drop them. When you take off the rubber covering on the rubber duck, it's probably got about 30 turns to it. It's a piece of stiff copper wire, probably oxygen hardened or whatever. So it's a very stiff piece of copper wire, about 30 turns. The bottom of the 30 turns is grounded. It goes to the outer shell of the connector. The center conductor of the connector touches a 3 picofarad capacitor. The far end of the 3 picofarad capacitor taps into the turns of the rubber duck about 10 turns up from the bottom. So it's a much more complicated rubber duck that has to cover two separate bands and a lot of frequencies within those bands. And so as you flex the rubber duck, you eventually fatigue the wire between the 3 picofarad capacitor and the SMA connector. Over to you, Paul, K2LAW. Once that becomes an open circuit, you lose a lot of sensitivity.
Oh, yeah, that sounds like they put a lot of thought to that, and it's not a typical design. I'm surprised they can sell these radios. You know, I know they have cheap labor and all, but for that kind of design, all those two bands. Wow. Oh, very good, Dick. So you got to be real careful not to move this, you know, bend this antenna one way or the other. That's what it sounds like. It sounds like they'll probably have a design change over the years. You know, maybe they'll stiffen up that part of the antenna where it can't be bent.
That's a conflict of interest. The rubber duck, by definition, has to be bendable. And is there some easy way of beefing up that connection? All the signals have to flow through the coil, the 3 picofarad capacitor that goes down to the center conductor of the connector coming out of the radio. So all the signals flow through that 3 picofarad capacitor. You could buy replacement antennas for this thing that don't have that vulnerability. It's a conventional rubber duct, sometimes longer, with a conventional connection. But those conventional antennas, I own a couple of them, they don't give you anywhere near the sensitivity on all of those bands, all of those frequencies of all of those bands. So they put a lot of thought into this crazy rubber duck, as I see it. But resoldering it, that's an art form. You would think you just reach in there and resolder the place where it breaks off. Well, at the bottom of the 3 picofarad capacitor, where it touches the connector center pin, you can't reach in there with a soldering iron because the turns of the rubber duck are so close together there. They're less than a wire diameter spacing, those turns. You can't get your soldering iron in there. Let me drop. So the only way you can fix it is to unsolder the top end of the 3 picofarad capacitor where it taps into 10 turns up. You unsolder that end. You then unwind the bottom of the rubber duck wire, which is wrapped around the outer shell of its connector. You then disconnect it from the connector. Resolder the 3 picofarad capacitor back on the center pin, and then you reverse the whole process of putting it all back together and resoldering the top end of 3 picofarad. That's the only way you can really repair it without bending the living daylights out of the rubber duck and never getting it back to the normal shape. Over to you, Paul, K2LIW.
Question?
And by the way, there's some YouTube videos to show you how to do this repair. Go ahead, Joe.
Is the junction of the capacitor breaking off the end of the SMA connector, and is it the actual lead of the component that's breaking or the solder connection? I'm just wondering if you use a thinner wire, in diameter, so it would give you more flexibility. The reason I ask is I have, a roll of 28-gauge wire, if something like that would help you. Because sometimes the leads of these parts may be just too stiff because it's too big.
Yeah, I thought about also, I've used various pieces of braid, small braid in there, for instance, like solder wick. And it doesn't work because as you bend the outer rubber coating of the rubber duck, and therefore you're flexing the wire itself inside, 10 turns up on that rubber duck, that spacing to the center pin changes. The pulling or pushing on that 3 picofarad capacitor total length connection. No easy way you could put a flexible lead in there and really take up the change in length required if you do any significant bending of the rubber duck. The answer is you got to make sure the rubber duck doesn't get significantly bent. Don't put this radio in your pocket. Over to you, Joe, K2LIW.
I just thought of maybe like the wire I sent you in the envelope that was able to help you poke up the jets or one of the things you were trying to fix one day, something of wire of that size, which is like 28-gauge wire. So very skinny would have some flexibility on it. You might be able to put a plastic sleeve on it to get it to not short against the spring that is, that goes around it. Just an idea, that's all.
Yeah, I'm sure there are better ways of doing it. But most of the ways that you give it slack are going to add extra length, which is going to change the tuning. So it's not an easy problem. Electronically, they've got a nice design. Mechanically, it cannot tolerate very much bending before it eventually fails. And is it the solder joint that comes apart, or do you fatigue the lead on the 3 picofarad capacitor? I'm not sure I can tell which. I think I've had one of each kind of failure, Joe. Go ahead.
Okay, all right. Well, if the solder junction is breaking, you simply can't take it. That's fine, because generally most parts I've seen, I don't think the wire gauge is much more than like 24 gauge on these, small capacitors, match head, size capacitors. I think the lead size is at least like 24 gauge. And like I said, the wire stuff I have is a whole roll of like 28 gauge wire, or something like that. Before you close on the tech debt, are you open for any kind of questions on something a little different, but it's an Elon Musk question?
Fire away.
Okay, in the past week or so, I just heard some news. I guess maybe you and Paul heard it also. Maybe Paul might be a little more up on it, because I guess he follows the Elon Musk thing that he's doing about this. I think they call it a Hyperloop. He's working on some project that, of course, is going to cost $1 billion to construct a tunnel or system of tunnels that are going to be able to contain a module operating in either near vacuum or total vacuum or whatever. I just want to know if you heard anything more about that, because it makes you think about it. I thought about two things right away. I guess they're going to have to do something to try to turbocharge the air to be able to get air inside the module that people are going to be traveling in, so you can make it like an aircraft traveling at a high altitude. It pressurizes the air and at least maintains a 10 or 12,000 foot altitude for the cabin. Number two, I wonder how they're going to make this tube rigid enough, or not rigid enough, flexible enough at several places, so if you had something happen like an earthquake, it wouldn't fracture this thing, and you'd have the immense air pressure also leaking into this thing, because of this module they want to send in this thing. Supposedly it's going to be traveling at close to 700 miles an hour to go between like New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore. Yeah, have you heard about this whole project?
Let's see if Paul's heard about that. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, Elon Musk proposed that Hyperloop probably 4 or 5 years ago, and he wants, his ultimate goal is to build one from San Francisco to L.A. But they were setting up a test piece. Test, I think, a 5 mile run somewhere out near Las Vegas. I think somebody else is involved with it. Came up with the idea. I don't know if any of his money is going into that right now. But I think somebody else got involved in it. So I don't know what the latest is on the Hyperloop actual construction. But I know on the desert they're setting this up as a test. But yeah, you're right. They want to eventually have these tubes carrying cylinders with people inside. It looked like one person lined up against the other, you know, sitting behind one another, and they fly through this tube at 700 miles an hour. I don't see it happening. They'd have to pull a vacuum in front of it, air pressure behind it, or they said they might be able to use maglev for the bottom, you know, to keep going. You know, I think it's 20 years off at least back there.
So the propulsion is maglev. This is a railroad. This is a subway car that runs in a vacuum tube that allows it to move real fast. And are you saying that the construction of a proof of concept has begun? In other words, they started construction of a sample piece in the desert to see how well the idea works. Have they started construction? That implies they've got some level of funding already. Back to you, Paul.
Yeah, but now this is over a year ago. I remember they were starting to get involved with actually building a 5 mile track out in the desert. But for some reason, it wasn't Musk. It was somebody else that was taking over his idea. A lot of his stuff is open source. You know, he doesn't care if other people take it. That's what happens. He's got this belief that he doesn't put a patent on anything. So I think it included the Hyperloop. But yeah, it's all over the internet, the Hyperloop system, for the last couple of years. I haven't read anything lately on it, but that's what I know about it. And I believe it was going to be maglev. The other version was just air pressure behind it and pulling a vacuum in front of it. I can't imagine this thing going 700 miles an hour through a tube. And like Joe said, one earthquake, they don't got you don't have to worry about it cracking. You see where those earthquakes do, they'll rip roads, bridges apart, and the thing doesn't stand a chance. Back to you, Dick. Looked real cool to fly on. I tell you, I used to drive past the same location every morning for jobs. You look up in Westbury, and I was around 10:30. I see the Concorde flying overhead, and, you know, heading into Kennedy. It really looked cool. What a shame.
Yeah, it's an extremely exotic-looking aircraft. Just sitting on the ground, it looks like it's moving a million miles an hour. Very similar to the SR-71. Both of them on the ground are beautiful aircraft. Fantastic technology. However, to move something at twice the speed of sound, I think Concorde went like 2.1, 2.2 times the speed of sound. SR-71 goes 3.2 times the speed of sound. When you're moving through the air that fast, air hitting the leading edge of all of your control surfaces, your wings and stabilizer and rudder and nose and whatever, is being compressed. Everyone calls it friction. It's really air compression that makes a huge amount of heat. So the skin of the aircraft is running 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit. That's a huge energy loss. You're burning fuel like it's going out of style. So your miles per gallon, unless you fly at 90,000 feet like SR-71 did, your miles per gallon goes up pretty fast. So Concorde is a small aircraft. Let me drop it. It's got a small fuselage diameter. It doesn't take a large number of passengers. It takes a huge amount of fuel, and a piece of foreign object material on that runway and wiped out the whole damn aircraft, and that was what ended the program. A piece of metal on the runway sheared the tire frayed, punctured the tank, and after that it was a disaster. So it's a very vulnerable aircraft, not very many passengers, very expensive to run, just to get people there an hour sooner. It's a tremendous amount of resource for a very small return on investment for each individual ticket. That's an opinion. Over to you, Paul, K2LIW. It's a beautiful thing to watch it fly.
Okay. Was it an hour difference? I thought go from, let's say, throw to here. What would it normally take? 7 hours? This thing was doing it in, like 3 hours or something?
You're probably right. Maybe it saved you 3 hours. But if the ticket was not being subsidized by the government on both sides, tickets might be a couple of $1,000 more expensive. 3 hours of your time worth a couple of $1,000. Over to you, Paul, K2LIW.
Well, not the majors, but yeah. You know, some people, they got money to burn, want to go on that thing. They come up with another one, and I tell you, NASA's working on one where it could fly over land without creating the sonic boom. If they ever develop a plane like that, that was fuel efficient. And that's what they're working on. You know, we talked about it earlier. NASA has these $19 billion a year program. You know, NASA is National Aeronautics and Space Administration. The aeronautics part is a big part of it. They're always spending money on developing all this new technology. And if some, you know, if they develop it and some private company, Boeing, decides to build something like this, people will be online to get on that thing. I guarantee it.
Do a real good computational fluid dynamics analysis program. Work on all the aerodynamics of your engine, slip and exhaust, the control surfaces, the aircraft and whatever. Do a whole lot of work on the aircraft and its engine. And if someone tells me you're going to take the sonic boom and cut it down by a 3-to-1 ratio, I can see that that's possible. But if somebody says, I'm going to move an aircraft at twice the speed of sound through the air, and it's going to have no sonic boom, boy, that sounds like more dream than reality. I'm not sure the laws of physics will let you do that, Paul. Over to you, K2LIW. How much sound abatement do they think they can achieve? Over to you, Paul.
They say there won't be a boom. It would be more of like a light roaring noise as it goes by. You know, you just barely hear it. Said it would be not noticeable. So, now they've done quite a few tests on this one design, and now they're looking to
gone through the different wind tunnels and want to build this thing. They have the picture of it if you go to the NASA site, what the thing would look like. And for now, it's going to be relatively small, probably put one pilot in there and that's going to be it. And then you just, increase the size as, if this thing is doable. Somebody, could make a, 100-passenger thing like the Concorde out of it. I think the Concorde only held 100 people.
Maybe not even that many. Now, what have they done to make it quieter? It's skinnier and longer. Instead of the shape of a bullet, it's the shape of a knitting needle. Over to you, Paul.
It does look skinnier and longer. It's got a long nose. So, we'll have to see. I forget what they call it. They had a name, preliminary design name. But, it looked like the pilot was pretty far back. And long nose thing on the front. But I don't know if it's got this traction that Concorde had it where the whole nose would drop so, the pilot could see. It doesn't look like it had any kind of setup like that. We'll see. I mean, 8 years away from actually putting something in the air.
If I had to study the price of making that pivot that allows the nose of Concorde to pivot down, to look at the price of all that hardware and the vulnerability, as opposed to a good television system that gives you viewability, except for the reliability of the television system, maybe I'd want two or three of them. Guarantee it's a lot cheaper. I mean, nowadays, a modern car, when you buy it, it's got a backup video system, so you can look behind the car by looking at your instrument panel to know what you're about to run over if you're backing up. So I'm sure it's going to have a video system. So not dropping the nose is a good solution to that. Making the nose very skinny and very long, that makes it enter that air very nicely, very quietly. But somewhere along that fuselage, you gotta have an engine input. Gotta have a wing. How in the world do you stop those bumpy objects from making noise and still be functional? W Ball, K2IW.
Alright, this design had one engine, look at the back wing, above that, so it's like in a tail, similar to a 727. The engine was above the wings, where Concorde, everything was below, the engines were below the wings, mounted to the front wing. So it looks like, maybe by having the engine above the back wing, that's a way to, suppress the sound. Don't know. That's a guess.
Yeah, you can move the engine further and further back. I'm not sure that stops it from making noise. It still has to scoop up a whole lot of air. The big picture, the inlet of an engine is a blunt object. And that air comes into the inlet of the engine at twice the speed of sound, if you're flying that fast. And when the air hits the very first compressor blade, that air has to be subsonic. No jet engine, no turbojet engine flies above the speed of sound. So you've got to have an object up front of the engine. There's a movable cone in the center of the engine, which takes that Mach 2 air and brings it down to Mach 0.9 before it hits the first compressor blade. To do that operation in a small number of inches of that cone and not create a sound barrier noise, that's a good trick. Isn't that amazing that all of those compressor blades and turbine blades and everything else, the whole innards of that jet engine flies below the speed of sound? Even though the exhaust, after it gets squeezed down by the tail feathers, the exhaust may come out of there at Mach 6. It gives you a hell of a lot of thrust. But inside that engine, all that air is moving less than the speed of sound, no matter how fast the airplane is moving. Over to you, Paul, K2IW.
Very good. I haven't noticed looking at the design of that. I'm not sure even what the intake looks like. I'll have to bring it back up again. I didn't pay that much attention to it. I mean, they had a couple of days. NASA, if you go to their NASA site, they'll bring up one topic every day, usually, sometimes two. This topic was stayed on that site. you know, it's what they get paid to do, design all this stuff. And then that becomes open source. You know, anybody can use it. Good about NASA. That's what I like about the, you know, the government projects. But the private projects, you know, they tend to move along. They allow to keep things secret. You know, NASA always releases information. Maybe not right away, but sooner or later you get information on what's going on. Looking at the time, we got about 4 minutes left. I don't know if anybody wants to say anything, but back to you, Dick. WS 20.
Now, I'll pass it over to you guys if you've got any further questions on any of the subjects. And Joe, if you're still with us, that 3 picofarad capacitor that goes down the center of the coil of the rubber duck, orange colored, 8-inch diameter disc ceramic capacitor with 2 radio leads coming out of it. So that's what that capacitor really is. WHYY, KTRIW.
And like I said, I bet you the gauge of that wire of the capacitor is probably not much smaller than 24 gauge. So it's going to limit its flexibility to some sort of point. That's why, you know, I thought like a, you know, I've seen some more 28 gauge wire to use it on the rigging something up. You know, I don't know if it changed the inductance tremendously on that part itself would make that much of a difference. That's a very strange design you're talking about. I mean, the only time I've ever heard of using any kind of capacitor stuff in antennas is to make like an 800 meg antenna have gain to it with a top and bottom or longer and much longer in wavelength than the actual operating frequency. And you use a capacitor coupling like plastic or some other insulator to make a capacitor coupling with anything. That's what when you start describing it, that's what I almost thought that this thing was doing. But it doesn't sound like they're doing that particular job with this capacitor, with feeding, you know, the center to the connected to some point up, which is some sort of impedance at some frequency. Very strange operation. How do you suppose that can actually make the thing physically work? Have you ever seen or heard of an antenna constructed something with something like that, where most of it's a helical and you're tapped, so many turns up, like in this case you said 10 turns up. That makes it, maybe it makes it work very well at lower frequencies. How well is it going to work at very, very high frequencies for efficiency?
Repeater, timeout.
Yep, it's a tapped coil antenna. By the way, many of the mag mount antennas, 5/8 wave mag mounts, really have a tapped helical coil, a tapped planar coil. What is it called now? Is it a helical coil? Spiral coil. A tapped spiral core in the magnetic structure in the base, feeding the 5/8 wave whip. So there's a degree of similarity here. And how does it really work on the various bands is a darn good question. But it does an awful good job, and any replacement antenna I've ever tried doesn't work as well as this vulnerable rubber duck. Okay, we're out of time. This was TechNet number 1660, and that was Space Report number 260 of the series. That began in September of 1982, essentially 35 years ago. 73, you all, be kind to each other. We'll see you all next week. WS2N for any final, K2RIW, clear but listening. Bye-bye, you all.
Okay, only one launch I'm going to pay attention to this week, and that'll be one from Kazakhstan, with one American on board, one guy from the European Space Agency, from Italy, and the Russian pilot or commander going up to the space station. So we'll watch that, or at least see it on the replay. NASA always puts it on. 73, be back next week. WS2N clear.
So one final comment, Dick, K2RWW2RY. You mentioned about the two systems, east and west. They're operating on a non-internet type of operation right now. That's why you don't have any kind of delay that you can hear audibly.
I kind of thought so. And Sam's talk is working rather well right now. Let's hope it keeps working. I know some of those computers are George Washington's unit that Eric would like to replace.
Well, they get old, they get finicky and things like that. The more stuff you put online, it becomes a problem. Sometimes it's just easier to do stuff on a non-internet type of basis. It's usually agile sometimes. You know, you can make stuff work on point-to-point, Radio's been around for a long time. You know that.
Yeah, I've heard that wireless techniques are going to catch on, particularly cell phones in people's pockets. Boy, the way people are dependent on that thing in their pocket these days, wow. I think they only consult it 30 times per day.
Oh, I use a cell phone, and I don't remember if you've ever said you carry one or you don't carry one, but I have a cell phone, but it's a dumb phone, not a smartphone. It's about a 20-year-old technology phone. I'm perfectly happy with it. It does exactly what I need to do. Makes phone calls only.
Yeah, my son does that just to save battery power. He's got a very bare-bones cell phone. He only has to charge it once per week.
Mine's like about once, about twice a month maybe, with the frequency I use it. They work very, very well that way. That's how these things are. I don't know how they make these batteries on these things last any amount of time at all, because everybody you see walking around with these, you know, 4 or 5 inch screen phones, they're running all the options, and I see one sitting on the train from time to time, and it's constantly using up the battery. It's amazing. Yep, it's amazing the world we live in there. Okay, catch you next week. I'll try to maybe have something a little better of a question than the one I brought up this week. I got to think about it. Let me get one way wide clear.
I'll be worrying about that. I guess in the worst case, when people are running all of those functions and applications simultaneously, some of those people have to recharge their battery almost once every 4 hours. Is it almost that bad?
Repeater, time out.
Well, it's kind of funny because on the train, there's only so many 110-volt sockets that you can find to plug your thing into. I do see more and more people now carrying torches with them, and they got the socket. One guy will be plugged in for a while, and another guy, can I plug my thing in for a while? Because, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, you just saw the people with, the phones. I hear myself cut off now, too. Oh, well, that's it.
Thank you for visiting the Pilot Mobile Amateur Radio on the New England Reflect.
Auto connecting.
Node number 912.
Well, Amateur Radio Club 9126.
Link active.
let me give you the bottle.
Put it in the right spot.
Rick, I know where to put it. Hold it, all right?
Yeah. It's great.
I know, but I've never seen that before.
And there's the gun.
Oh, okay.
So moving with the right.
Okay, okay, so I haven't seen
Miles.
Somebody coming from Plainview Road
total control, went across three lawns on my side, and then crossed over and like threw it to the other side and hit a tree.
Doesn't sound like they were very happy.
No. And in fact, there was a period of time where we had a lot of accidents. And I think it was probably because of the lack of the stop sign. Once they put the stop sign, you had to accelerate anyway. My car, my neighbor, I'd say three or four neighbors in a row on my side of the street all had their cars hit at one point or another.
Considering you park in your driveway, that's a real trip.
Yeah, but originally, when I was driving, and we had two cars, we only had one car driveway, and I would park in the street because I was getting up early, obviously, to leave. Just in case I was the first one in the day before, I didn't want my wife pulling them behind me, where that would have made it, you know, tough. So, but one day, I get a knock on the door, and one of my neighbors says, your car's in my driveway. It's not empty, you know. You know, somebody says that, you're thinking all kinds of crazy things. Was I, like, in a stupor when I got home and I pulled it? No, what happened was somebody came down, plowed into my car, actually knocked it about 80 feet. And my car was parked on the street facing towards Albert Page Road. They knocked it into my neighbor's driveway facing garage.
Lovely. I take it they didn't bother to stop or something.
Yeah, I'm sorry, did you say the car stopped? Yeah, no, is that what you asked, if the car stopped?
Well, the person who hit you, one would think you would not need your neighbors to notify you about something like that.
No, my neighbors came in, but I think the person, you know what, it's interesting. My three kids all took driver's ed, all had accidents before they were 18, and that was the case with my car that was hit. And it was interesting because, again, it was a young girl, 17, just driving, taking a gate. Well, I'm speculating driver's ed, but 17, she would have had to take driver's ed. And she hit my car, and, you know, of course, she was stunned by it, but she said that her driver's ed teacher had said, if you think you're going to hit something, hit a stationary car rather than a car that's moving. And what happened was she felt that a car coming in the opposite direction was heading towards her, so she hit my stationary car.
Okay. There's a reason for it.
Yeah. And, well, of course, the impact would be less hitting a stationary car than hitting a car coming at you with the forces of motion doubled or tripled or quadrupled what it is as they head towards you. But, yeah, that was it. It was just weird. And then one day, I look out the window and the car's in the middle of the road. How did that happen? My son got in the car. I guess they left the door open. We leave emergency brake, rolled out into the street. Just lucky no cars came by. Oh, well.
Yeah, I understand that one. Oh, well. Well, actually making pretty good time. I'm actually at bike 107.
Yeah, that is good time. Well, maybe the rain kept people away. I think they said rain till 11 o'clock this morning. I have to look at the weather forecast. We're supposed to have a garage sale here on Saturday, but I think the weather forecast for the 10-day was pretty good.
After you sell the garage, what do you use?
Yeah, that's when you buy one of those pop-up tents, you know, 10 by 20, put the car in there. And it would be cool if I could sell the garage. Well, I'd rather rent it, you know, get a monthly stipend from it or something.
Then where would you put all the stuff you're hiding in there? WPTC, I think.
You know, we converted the garage, it's 18 years. My mother was supposed to come and live with us. And we had to do it in a quick situation because she was in the hospital and she was supposed to get out and would not have been able to come up on, in a split on any floor other than ground level. But you don't realize, obviously, how valuable the garage becomes as a storage place. Everything that was in the garage is actually in my shed right now, and it's just not the same. First of all, it's outside, more susceptible to humidity in the summertime, freezing in the wintertime. But in the garage, you know, you put, I don't know, paint, liquids, other things, didn't have those problems.
I understand. Let me make a quick phone call. Excuse me. I got to see if I can pry Eric outside to walk in. And I'll be right back.
just this. Good morning. It's only like...
It's pretty early for you, Ron.
Not really. He's in tough. Probably about 8:30 go to the gym. Well, the pool is later. We leave later. At 9:30, 9:45. My wife and I piecemeal are trying to clean out our garage because there's need work to be done in there. And you forget you have stuff. And stuff in boxes has been here for 20 years and 30 years or more than that. And, I was looking for this and I still have this and I forgot about this. And I try to throw out and she tries to save. She's the saver and I'm the thrower out.
Yeah, I think we're both savers here. But the thing is that I'm going through stuff now so that we can have a garage sale. And, you know, a couple years back I had put a stack of books on a desk for my kids to go through. Both my sons are lawyers. Both of them have their books from law school. One of them has maintained pretty much a law library in his house. The other one, not so much. But I have all their books. The books, you know, many of them, some of them still have current value because the law hasn't changed. But some of them were specific textbooks that no longer have a value. You know, my younger one graduated law school 18 years ago. So, I started pulling the books out, but then as I pulled them out, there was other stuff behind them that I had forgotten that was there, or in the stack of books were some books that I may have wanted myself. So I'm just trying to pull them out, put them in a place where they can go through them, pick out what they want, and we'll put the rest out in the garage sale, and if it's not in the garage sale, we'll put them out for collection. But it is funny, you know, I mean, it would take forever to sell this house, to clear out the stuff that we have, and I know a lot of people say it, but that is the case.
We've been there 48 years, more than that, closer to 49 years, and you collect and accumulate so much junk. When my children got married, they left, and they left a lot of stuff behind. Then they would come over, I said, well, take this. Oh, save it. Why would I save it? It's not mine. I'm not used to it. So I'll throw it out. Oh, no, don't throw it out. So they'll take it. But I'm telling you, it is a lot of work, especially as you get older. Who needs this work?
It can be. That's funny because that's exactly what I get from my kids. Three of them out of the house. Two of them are in their own homes. One of them's in an apartment. So I can understand he's not, you know, wanting things. But I have a desk. I have filing cabinets. I have their books. And they'll say to me, well, Dad, you don't keep the basement too neat. I say, I know, but, you know, you guys don't give me any room to even do the stuff that I have. I have hobbies. I have business. I have other things going on down there. So I think this is a good opportunity. I can't tell you. Let me think. I have at least 15 pieces of stereo equipment that belong to my kids because as they upgraded, they didn't want to throw it out, but they couldn't store it, so they dropped it off at this house. I can't even tell you. Amplifiers, equalizers, turntables, things like that. It's just crazy.
And to the edge, you see Mobile not far from the gym. I hope you're able to offer it to someone at a good price at the garage sale and have it move out.
Yeah, we're using the garage sale more as a clean out rather than a money maker. So I think that